Hi, my name is David Ansel, and I am here to talk to you today about the Catholic Church's teaching on human life and the dignity of the human person. And to sum it up for you today, human beings, both men and women, are made in the image and likeness of God Himself. We were created to live in union with God. And through baptism, we even become adopted sons and daughters of God. And when you're given this dignity that is bestowed on us by God, we can see that every human life is sacred from conception to natural death. Now, of course, today we're talking about something that is very serious. And one of the things that I really want to preface this by saying, because I know that there may be some people listening that either you have something in your past regarding this, or maybe you know somebody who does. God does not just forgive sins because they're no big deal. Our sins are a big deal, actually. It's important we understand that. He forgives sin because of the greatness of His love and His mercy. We don't talk about these things so that people will be condemned. We do it so that they won't. I can remember being on retreat not too long ago and hearing a priest talk about how occasionally he'll have somebody come to him who is confessing a very serious sin. And of course, he'll have to tell them, hey, that is very serious. But guess what? God's mercy is serious. And God wants to forgive you right now. And so, if anybody really does feel convicted by anything that we're talking about today, please, if you have been baptized, then don't be afraid to go to confession. Of course, if you haven't been, then when you are baptized, the sin will be washed away. Because God does have great love and great mercy. And we want you to receive that mercy if you're in need, which we are all in need, of course. Now, the other thing that I want to preface this talk with is the fact that, and of course, I'm going to be back next week, by the way, to talk about Catholic social teaching. And the life issues do kind of fit in with the social teaching of the church as well, but we've intentionally separated this out because human life, obviously, is the most important, most urgent, and most basic. It's really hard to talk about the rights of a human being before other people without establishing that they have a right to life. And also the fact that the life issues also contain things that are direct, what we call intrinsic evil, which I'm going to get to that a little bit more later. But in the confusion of our age, we have seen, and even among people who claim to be Catholic, the life issues that are either downplayed or ignored altogether. And one famous proposal that has been problematic to a lot of people, and I'll be talking about this a little bit more later, is called the seamless garment. And if you've heard that, there are some real problems that were caused by that. Now, the teachings, especially the social teachings of the church, really have a couple of big points that form the basis of this, and I'm going to talk about one of them today, and I'm going to talk about one of them next week with social teaching because it fits better there. Today, I want to talk about the dignity of the human person. You see, God was all content in Himself. He didn't need anything, and He certainly doesn't need us, but in a pure act of love, God chose to create. And of course, in that He created man. And the human beings are the only creatures that God created for His own sake. And you can read in the scriptures in Genesis chapter 1, verse 26 through 28, that God created us in His own image and likeness. He created us body and soul, and we are the only creatures who are persons who are created this way, because God is a person. He's a divine person, but until the second person of the Trinity took on a human nature. He had no body. Angels are persons, but they have no body. But we as human beings are body and soul. He created us male and female. And like I mentioned earlier, we are equally in God's image and equal in dignity, whether you're a man or a woman. Now, that doesn't mean to say we're the exact same. It's important to understand that we are not interchangeable parts, which is what the world wants us to think, that men and women should just be just interchangeable parts with no real differences. That's not really true, but that's going to be for someone else to talk about later. But God gave us dominion over all the earth in creating us. Now, you look at the animals, because a lot of people have tried to make them out to be kind of human or say that we're just like the animals. The animals may have a rudimentary society, like a bunch of dogs may hang out together in a pack. They may be able to build, say, rudimentary shelters like a bird that can build a nest. But they can't do anything like what we've been able to do as human beings. Now, as the ones whom God gave the dominion over the earth, we do owe kindness to the animals. But an interesting thing, if you look in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, if we do not do this duty and we are not good to the animals, it's not their rights that we violated. And the reason why is because there is no such thing as animal rights. They do not have rights. Rather, it's our dignity as human beings that we offend by being cruel to animals. But we do, as the ones who have the dominion over all the earth, have the right to use animals for food and shelter, and we can domesticate them for work and for leisure. So, you know, you can have your donkeys carrying some loads for you, or ride your horse, or have a dog or a cat or as a pet, but it would be absolutely immoral if, say, we ran out of food somewhere to kill somebody and eat them. Can't do that with human beings. We have a different dignity. And in creating us, God has put us here in a real world. This world is not just some holding tank until we just end up in eternity. We have real work to do here. For example, if husbands and wives do not bring forth children, then those people are just not going to exist. If we don't go and do the charitable deeds, they won't be done. And if you don't have people like I'm trying to do right now, and a lot of other people have been doing, I'm sure you've seen, people teaching the faith, it's not going to be taught. He gave us that share in the work, and it's real work that we really do need to do, not because God needs it, but because he created us to do this. But ultimately, we were created for union with God. God gave us intellect and will. Intellect, the ability to think, and will, the ability to choose. And he gave us that freedom so that we could freely choose to love God. He's not forcing us. He's called us to be a temple of the Holy Spirit. You can find this in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 19. And then, when the human race fell, because of the disobedience of Adam and Eve, he sent his son to redeem us and to die on the cross for our salvation. He did not do that for any other creatures. The angels, when they rebelled, they were not given, the ones that did, they didn't all, of course. He didn't give them another chance. The ones who are down in hell, that's where they're going to be. Now, with this dignity that God has given us, and also just from the holiness of God himself, there are some actions that are such violations that they must never be done under any circumstances. We call those acts intrinsic evil. Or a definition would be an act that of its very nature is not in conformity with divine law. Murder, of course, is one. Blasphemy is another, just to give another kind of example. Now, just to kind of show where we're going with this, I'm going to do a very brief review of the basic principles of morality. I'm hoping this is already a review that you've already had, but if not, then here's a good time to present it. It's something that I call the tripod of morality. That's not an official term of any kind, but I just think that a tripod is a great analogy to use because there's three components to an act that all have to check out in order for an act to be good or at least morally acceptable. And one of them is the objective act itself. The second is the intention of the person doing it. And the third one is the situation, the circumstances under which the act is performed. We can actually ruin a good act by doing it with a less than honorable intention or in circumstances that are not appropriate for that act. But no intention and no situation can make an intrinsically evil act good or even okay. If you look in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, it's actually Article 1789. It says point blank that one may never do evil so that good may result from it. And of course, one of those actions, just like I said, is murder, the intentional killing of the innocent. And that makes my segue into talking about human life. Human life is a sacred gift from God. And like I'd mentioned in my introduction, that it must be held as sacred from conception to natural death. Back in 1995, with an awareness of what Pope St. John Paul II called a culture of death, he wrote an encyclical called Evangelium Vitae, and that means the gospel of life, really teaching us all as Catholics to really be a part of building a culture of life. And I really like how he introduced what he said. But before I get into that, I want to mention one little thing, and that God did not create us to die, first of all. You can look at this in the Book of Wisdom, chapter 1, verses 13 to 14. It says that God did not make death, nor does he delight in the death of the living, but he created all things that they might exist. There is no destructive poison among them. And when Jesus came in the Gospel of John, he said that he came that we may have life and have it abundantly. Now, of course, this is going to achieve its full significance when we go to heaven. But we can begin to have that life now. Eternal life begins now, not when we die. We won't have it in its fullness, but living in union with God, we do start to have it. But obviously, the fullness of life, like I said, it's not happening this earthly life. It far exceeds the dimensions of this earthly life because it's going to be a sharing in the very life of God. But it is this calling that we have. Like I said, it begins now. It means that even in this temporal life that we have, this life is of very great value. Death itself really entered the world through sin, through Adam and Eve's partaking of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. You can see in the beginning of the book of Genesis. And from that, one of the first things you see, actually even before a death is mentioned, is the beginnings of lust, when they had to sow the fig leaves on themselves, which is kind of interesting because that, you know, human sexuality is really at the very beginning of human life here. So for that to have been corrupted, it kind of ties in that death would also come into the world. But when you have the talk on the issues of human sexuality, someone will explain that a little bit better. I don't want to steal that person's thunder. But it is also interesting to note that the very first death recorded in Scripture, it's in Genesis chapter 4, verse 8, it was a murder. Cain kills his brother Abel. So death really came for the first time by violence. Now, I'm going to talk about some specific issues. And I'm going to start with one that's going to be the one that I'm going to spend the most time on because it seems to have gotten a lot of social acceptance, probably more than the others, and that is abortion. You can read about it in the Catechism of the Catholic Church. It's paragraphs 2270 to 2275. And basically, abortion is the deliberate killing of an unborn child in the womb of the mother. I can't think of any life issue that's really more pressing and more urgent. If for no other reason, on the sheer scale that it happens, and it's a mother against her own child here. I went for a neutral source here, and I looked at the CDC's numbers, the Center for Disease Control. The latest statistic I could find was 2015, and they reported 638,169 abortions in 2015. However, there were three states that declined to release numbers to the CDC, and there are some estimates that the number really may be closer to 9,000. So you're talking about a massive number of people dying. And lately in the news, we've seen a lot more horrific cases. We've heard of Planned Parenthood actually selling the body parts of the aborted children. And also, and there's been a movie about this next one, but it's the case of Kermit Gosnell, the abortionist in the Philadelphia area. He was a late-term abortionist, although he was even more late-term than that because he was convicted, actually, of first-degree murder in May 2013 because he was allowing the children to be born alive in some cases and then would snip the spinal cord with scissors. He was also convicted in manslaughter in the death of one of his patients, and he's serving life without parole. His clinic was also known as just a little shop of horrors. It was very unsanitary, blood everywhere. I didn't want to go into all the gore, and it was kind of interesting that because of the societal attitude towards abortion nowadays, that when he went on trial, the press box was curiously empty, or at least it wasn't nearly as full as normally one would expect for a trial like this. Unfortunately, we see a lot of people still vigorously defending the practice of abortion in the secular world. And sadly, even among some people who claim to be Catholic. They often oppose even things like requiring the clinics to have the standards of a surgical center, possibly even inspections or ultrasounds. And granted, you know, we do want to use these to try to keep people from having an abortion, but if they're really interested in choice, as they call it being pro-choice, then wouldn't they want the woman to be able to make an informed choice and to be in a sanitary environment? But when you hear their comments, they're like more worried about quote unquote access to abortion and how requiring standards might limit access to abortion. It's just really sickening the way it's defended. The church teaching on abortion is very clear. The Catechism of the Catholic Church, paragraph 2271, says that since the first century, the church has affirmed the moral evil of every procured abortion. Goes on to say, this teaching has not changed and remains unchangeable. Direct abortion, that is to say, abortion willed either as an end or as a means, is gravely contrary to the moral law. It then goes on to quote a document written by the very next generation of Christians after the apostles, where abortion was mentioned as something wrong. In the next paragraph, the Catechism also goes on to say that formal cooperation constitutes a grave offense. So if you're cooperating in somebody having abortion, and it carries the penalty of excommunication. Although I honestly think that doesn't happen a whole lot. It might, but in most places, the priests have been given the ability to absolve the excommunication. The sinfulness of abortion, by the way, also includes things like embryonic stem cell research, where they're using the tiny embryos as research objects, and the use of the morning after pill that often works by keeping a conceived embryo from implanting in the uterus. Remember, life is sacred from conception to natural death. life begins at conception. Now, I want to go into a way of explaining how to understand and how we can really realize that abortion is sinful. Because, no doubt, some people may feel some objections, or you may know some people who do. I remember back in 1999 when I was a pharmacy resident in drug information, and there was another resident there, and he was to give a talk on ethics to the students who were working in the center. Unfortunately, I will tell you that there's a couple things I'll go through with him, but I was really not equipped to answer him as well as I wish I had been, and that's one of the reasons why I'm going through what I am, is to help equip you as well. He would say that so many people believe so many different things, and you really just believe what you believe because you've been taught. So how can anyone really say that what they believe is right? The interesting thing that I wasn't really equipped to say at that time is that he seemed to be so sure that he was right in saying that nobody was able to say that they were right. And you will often hear people also who say, well, I'm against abortion, but I really can't tell anybody else to have one. And we do have problems with Catholic politicians who say, yeah, I mean, I realize that abortion is really a bad thing. It's wrong, but, you know, it's wrong for me to impose my moral values on others. And then they actively support abortion. We also have some problems with others who maybe do oppose abortion. They recognize it as wrong, but they downplay it in light of other social or economic issues. And I've still got more to come on that one. But the basis for the church's teaching against abortion is that the unborn child from the moment of conception is a human being just like anyone else. And that new life is always a positive good, even if the circumstances are not the best. I knew a fellow pharmacist one time who had consulted her minister and said that they were okay with the use of the morning after pill because, well, do you want a 14-year-old to have a baby? Well, we may not really want 14-year-olds to have a baby, but the fact is if there is a conceived child there, it is a life and it is a positive good. And that moment of conception is really the only place of absolute change. Because before then, there's not all of the genetic material. The sperm and egg are not going to grow into a mature human being without being united. At that point is when it's going to happen, as long as the food and nutrition are added. Pretty much any other distinction is arbitrary. And if we're going to talk about not being able to decide things for everybody else, well, who are we going to let decide who is a human being or who is not? And ultimately, either the unborn child is a human being or the unborn child is not. Someone cannot be a human being, but yet not be a human being at the same time. Either is or it isn't. And it's something that either we know or can know, or we can't and don't. And it's important to realize this. In fact, if you want a really good treatment of this in a book, I would highly recommend Peter Kreef's book, Making Choices. Because obviously the church is teaching that the unborn child is a human being, and we do know it, which of course makes abortion murder. The only way abortion could really not be, at least not be as problematic, is if the unborn child is not human, but yet we know that the unborn child is not human. And how are you going to decide that, and how are you going to prove that? Obviously, if you can, then you've basically shot down my case. But what if someone wants to argue that we don't know it? I mean, that resident that I spoke of actually talked about how he struggled to figure out when life begins. And unfortunately, I didn't have the best answer to offer him, but since then, I've done a lot of studying. In fact, actually being in there with him kind of gave me the incentive to really start to get to know my faith and understand, can we know the truth and how can we know it? And I'm, of course, really talking about the truth about God, but also the truth about every moral issue. So here's the thing. Let's say as we're here, someone comes in here and says, guys, y'all need to evacuate this building. We need to fumigate. So we do that. We leave the building. We go outside. We look around. We're talking to each other. Looks like almost everybody's out, but wait a minute. Where's Susan? Maybe she's in the building. We don't know where she is. Maybe she's not. She's either in the building or she's not. She can't be in there but not in there at the same time. Don't you think we ought to try to find out? And if we can't find out, should we go ahead and fumigate the building? Because obviously, if they told me, hey, you tell us when we can do it, and I decide just to go ahead and fumigate, and she's there, and we're finally allowed to come back in, and then we find her dead on the floor, or really seriously ill, I mean, I may even be criminally liable for that, even though, you know, hey, I didn't know. That's not going to look really good before law enforcement. Obviously, I made a very reckless decision that resulted in somebody's death, and I had at least some knowledge that it was reckless. But even if she's not in the building, maybe she just went home and forgot to tell us, and I give the go-ahead, even if she turns out not to be there, did I make a good decision? No way. My decision has no more wisdom than that of the winner of a coin toss. The decision is just as bad. And you can look in some theological writings of even people centuries ago that, and this was before we had the science we had today, of course, so I don't think they would be saying this today as to when does the conceived child in the womb have a soul. Those debates do exist, but it's important to understand that even the ones who would debate this would say, but the mere possibility of life is enough to decide that we cannot destroy it. Someone should not have an abortion. And this is something that, yes, we should seek to make it illegal, because some people will bring that argument that maybe we should do something like take care of the circumstances that cause people to have abortions, but not really make it legal. You know, we used to hear that years ago, that people wanted abortion to be legal, safe, and rare. Now it seems like the mantra is abortion on demand and without apology. They're definitely much more vigorous in their support of abortion. But think of it this way. Imagine saying, well, we need to take care of the circumstances that cause men to beat their wives, but spousal abuse shouldn't be illegal. Not too many people are going to say that. Why would they say that for abortion? Anyway, if you look at Pope John Paul II's Evangelium Vitae, he actually says, point blank, those in public office have a grave and clear obligation to oppose any law that attacks human life. Now, he did make provision for a case where, say, you're not able to completely overturn an unjust law, but you could do something to weaken it when the alternative is to let the more liberal law to stand. That is perfectly licit. It is perfectly licit if you've got two candidates, for example, for public office that are not really great, to vote for one just to limit the evil that the other one can do. Limiting evil where you can is legitimate. He goes on to say that the cooperation, the formal cooperation in evil actions, can never be justified either by invoking respect for the freedom of others or by appealing to the fact that civil law permits or requires it. In other words, unjust law, we have a duty to disobey. This was repeated in 2002 by the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. It's the Vatican office that deals with matters of doctrine. that it was a publication based on the duties of people in public office, lists the number of intrinsic evils, and mentions that when political activity comes up against moral principles that do not admit of exception, compromise, or derogation, the Catholic commitment becomes more evident and laden with responsibility. So someone who is publicly and politically supporting abortion has no basis and no excuse in church teaching. Now, the moment that I've alluded to at least a couple of times, the seamless garment. What is that? Or the consistent ethic of life, it's often called as well. The term came from a speech given, I believe, at St. Louis University on March 11th, 1984, by the late Joseph Cardinal Bernardine. Cardinal Bernardine was the Archbishop of Chicago. I believe he passed away in 1996. Now, he'd been alluding to this probably as early as 1976. And it's kind of interesting that there was a biographer of his who actually said that he was very concerned about abortion taking over all of Catholic political participation in the United States after the passage of Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court decision which legalized abortion. His desire was to underscore attention to a spectrum of issues that included abortion, but also from everything from war and capital punishment to issues like poverty and rights of workers, all these being intertwined and all putting them all under the teaching of the sanctity of life. And to be perfectly honest, as I will be talking about next week, there genuinely are other social teaching issues that we really cannot ignore as Catholics, and there may be some people guilty of doing so. However, let me explain the problem with the seamless garment approach. Although it is debatable whether the problem is really with the seamless garment itself or how it has been applied. And you can actually Google the seamless garment, Cardinal Bernardine. You can listen to, or you can read what he actually said, and you can make your own judgment as to what you think about it. But realize what's happened as a result of it really is problematic regardless. And let me give you an idea of how this works. Imagine that you're walking around, say, downtown somewhere, and you see that there's a murder in progress. Somebody's about to kill somebody, and you go get the police officer that's nearby. And that police officer says to you, well, no, not now. I'm too busy ticketing this substandard housing or ticketing this business that's paying substandard wages. Surely we can see something's wrong with that. The issues are not equal. The direct taking of a human life, besides being an intrinsic evil, is obviously a much more serious and much more urgent problem. But what's often happened, for example, one cardinal, I'm not even going to tell you his name, when he was writing about the story of Planned Parenthood selling the parts of the babies they'd aborted, he said that we should be appalled by that, but then turned around and said we should be equally appalled by the plight of the immigrant or unemployment. And he named off another whole list of issues like that. Well, I mean, I hope that you would feel sorry for me if I was unemployed, but I hope that you would be even more appalled if I'd been chopped into pieces. There are people who will state things like, well, you're not really pro-life unless you're in favor of just about anything but opposition to abortion. And what ends up happening is people are using this to justify one of two things, either being pro-abortion or maybe not being pro-abortion, but supporting someone who is and not giving the abortion issue due consideration. Another term that I keep seeing circulating these days is people being called pro-birth. In other words, you're not really pro-life, you're just pro-birth because you oppose these other issues. Now, if someone is pro-choice, as they call it, I don't really see how they can really say that they're taking a high ground in a case like this, because if you're not pro-birth, then that would make you in favor of killing it. I mean, is that your alternative, that it's okay to support killing human beings as long as you're in favor of good wages for workers, which is something you should support, but it doesn't take the place of being pro-life. So there's no real high ground there, and even though they try to act like it. Now, there's one little, I don't really want to call it an exception because it's not an exception, but it's called the double effect. Basically, under no circumstances may a direct killing of an unborn child be done, but if, for example, a pregnant woman finds out she has cancer and she wants to undergo chemotherapy, even though that chemotherapy will ultimately, but not with the intention of doing so, end up killing the unborn child, that is permitted. There is a very grave reason for her to do that, and the death of the child is not the direct thing that she's trying to do, but rather it's an unwanted result, and that is morally acceptable. However, that doesn't mean that she's got to do that. Let me tell you about St. Gianna Mala. She's a physician, lived from 1922 to 1962, and she was pregnant with her fourth child, and I believe it was a uterine fibroid tumor that she had. And she had a choice. I mean, she could have a hysterectomy to remove that tumor, which of course would have meant that her unborn child would have died, or she could have just worked on the tumor, which didn't have as good a chance at saving her life. And she basically said, you know, if it's my life or the child's, let the child live. She was not going to do anything to harm the baby. And ultimately what ended up happening is that the baby did survive, but she died not too long after the birth. And for her heroic sacrifice for the life of this baby, she was canonized. She's now St. Gianna Mala in 2004. And just for fun, an interesting note about this, her husband actually lived well into his 90s and passed away in 2010. And that basically means that he was the very first husband in the history of the church to see his wife be canonized. In fact, I believe St. Gianna was also the first person to be canonized who had living children. And from what I've read, the child that survived based on her heroic sacrifice was at the canonization. So you do have the option to make that heroic sacrifice, and it could be your way of getting into heaven, but you are not morally required to do that in these cases. You know, she went above and beyond. So that's all I have on abortion. I know I've spent quite a lot of time on it, but I want to talk about another issue of life that's, well, I'm going to put two of them together here that have really become a lot more prominent lately, really having to do with the preservation of our own life. We have a duty, because God has given us this great gift, to take ordinary care of our body and to do ordinary treatment to save our life when need be. So we don't. There's a thing called extraordinary care that we don't have an obligation to do, and I'm going to explain a little bit more about that later. But for example, for ordinary care, if you had pneumonia, you couldn't just choose to forego the antibiotic when it could cure you and restore you to health. Neither can you forego the antibiotic saying that, well, I'm just going to rub this essential oil on myself or take this homeopathic remedy when we have something we know what's going to work. We have a duty to exercise proper prudence. The most obvious offense against this, and I want to be kind of careful here, because I'm going to talk about suicide, and I realize that maybe some of you have been through it where somebody you knew and loved had done that, and I realize it's a horribly devastating thing, and for good reason that it is. I mean, God's gift of life is something that we are to accept with gratitude. You can see this, by the way, in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, 2280 to 2283. Our life is really not ours to dispose of. And suicide is a very serious sin, but generally people who do this are not really in the best state of mind, and a very serious psychological disturbance or anguish or fear of some kind can diminish the moral responsibility of someone who commits suicide. Because of this, and one other thing I'll mention in a minute, we really don't want to despair if somebody you know and love has taken his or her own life. We really hope for God's mercy for those people. At one time, the church would refuse a funeral mass for someone who committed suicide, but almost always these days, they would presume that there was some mental problem involved with the person who did this. So unless there's some obvious scandal here or obvious deliberate act, then that would not happen today. And granted, one of the hardest parts about it is that with suicide, the time for repentance of this tends to be very short. However, it's not outside the realm of possibility. Let me just tell you a story on this. If you were to go to San Francisco, California, to the Golden Gate Bridge, you're going to see that there are these call boxes all along the bridge to call a counselor if you need help. You know, please don't jump off this bridge. It will be fatal. In fact, the Golden Gate Bridge, falls from that bridge, have one of the highest fatality rates, at least much above average. But there was a man named Kevin Hines who did survive jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge in an attempt to suicide. And this man did have mental problems. I believe he has bipolar disorder, from what I've read. I will just say, well, the biggest part about his story that really made an impact on me, and really in a way can kind of give you hope, is that he mentioned that the moment he fell off this bridge, or jumped off the bridge, really, the moment he started his fall, he was filled with instant regret at having done that. So we do have hope for people who've taken their own lives. It is a very serious violation of the love of God. But, you know, we always want to hope for the mercy of God for anybody who dies. Likewise, we're seeing the legalization of physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia, which the church will define as an act or an omission, like basically refusing necessary medical treatment, which causes or is intended to cause death as a means to eliminate suffering. The church calls that a murder gravely contrary to the dignity of the human person, to the respect due to the living God, his creator. This is an act that basically treats a sick person as a burden rather than a person to be loved. It denies them a chance to use their suffering by uniting it with Christ. And it, like I said, our lives are not ours to dispose of. If God wants us here, then we cannot just kill somebody. God may well have them there for a reason. And even if that's not very convincing, realize that our health system is known for being very expensive, and there are a lot of people out there looking for ways to save money. I'm a pharmacist. I hear about these things all the time, about how someone's looking for ways to do rational care so that we can do it at the best price and the best cost. It wouldn't take much for some unscrupulous person to say, hey, why should we keep these people alive? It's going to save a lot of money if we just put them out of their misery. And that people become coerced into either accepting physician-assisted suicide or killing themselves. And it also may even eliminate incentives to be able to treat these people or to give them what they call palliative care, which is care to just make them more comfortable. However, it is important to understand, though, that if death is imminent, if somebody is almost certainly going to die soon, it is perfectly morally acceptable to discontinue or refuse a procedure that's really burdensome or dangerous or what we call extraordinary care, or it's disproportionate to the expected outcome. Because when you do this, you're not really trying to kill somebody. You're just simply recognizing that you're not able to save their lives. You know, for example, if someone were to have terminal cancer and they were told, hey, we have this treatment for you. It's this really awful chemotherapy with a lot of side effects. It's $50,000 a dose. You can do it once a week, and it has about a 20% chance of extending your life by 1 month. You would not be obligated to undergo that treatment. However, you're not obligated to refuse that treatment. But and let me also mention before I go further on this, though, that cost can be one of the factors in determining the burden of the treatment, but it certainly should not be the only one. But one can opt for even more extraordinary treatments. If you've heard of the case of Charlie Gard, the infant that had a congenital brain abnormality and probably wasn't likely to live very long, but the parents, they even got their own money raised to bring him to the United States to try to give him this nucleoside therapy. It was really not something probably that had a great chance of working, but they wanted to do whatever they could for their child. This is perfectly morally legitimate. The sad part is that the British government, not only did they not provide the treatment, but they refused to allow the parents to take the child at their own expense to be treated. What they did was horrible. But even in the case of someone who's dying, ordinary care, and especially you can consider palliative care, cannot be refused to someone who needs it. We don't quit feeding them if they can eat, for example. In fact, speaking of that, just as a clarifying note, food and nutrition, even through, say, a feeding tube or even through the veins and what we call TPN, artificial means like that, are to be considered ordinary care. This was clarified by the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith in 2007 in a document they put together. So just because it's a feeding tube, you would not call that extraordinary care unless the person's body just could not absorb nutrients, and that would be the only reason for discontinuing it. Now, this is true whether death is imminent or not. Because I'm going to give you an example here. From years ago, I remember the case of Terry Schiavo, who was in what they called a persistent vegetative state. Or at least maybe. There were some disputes about her condition and to how much mental function she still had. But there was one thing that really was not disputed. She wasn't dying. However, her husband insisted and got a court order to have that feeding tube removed, and she did die of the starvation. Completely immoral to discontinue that feeding tube, no question. So next I'm going to talk a little bit about capital punishment. And right now this is kind of hard to talk about, because traditionally the church has allowed the death penalty. Pope St. John Paul II really kind of boxed it in and said, you know, unless it's absolutely necessary, and that should be rare if at all, it shouldn't be used. And now Pope Francis has basically said, no, it shouldn't be used. However, from what I understand, I don't think that it is intrinsically evil, because we're not talking about an innocent person here. But I do, of course, oppose the death penalty, and I would definitely think that that is the better course of action to do so. And the last life issue I'm going to talk about is legitimate defense and just war. We do have a right to defend ourselves against an unjust aggressor, an intruder into our home, because we are more obliged to take care of our own life than that of another person. This is in the Catechism of the Catholic Church in its paragraphs 2264 to 2265. But we cannot use more than necessary violence. However, it may be that in order to stop an unjust aggressor, we have to do something that ends up dealing him a lethal blow, and that is morally permissible when it is necessary. Now, you may read some people that have a little bit more pacifist tendencies that will say, hey, if somebody breaks in and tries to kill me, I'm just going to let them because I don't want to take anybody's life. If you're just talking about your own life, then yes, you do have the moral right to take that stance. So when I was single and lived on my own, then somebody came in, I wanted to let them kill me instead of me taking their lives. I could. However, I don't have that right when it comes to my family now. I can't just say I'm just going to let them kill all of us. I am responsible for their welfare, and I have a grave duty to defend them if possible. Likewise, the people responsible for the common good, and normally we're talking about our government, our civil authority, also has an obligation to defend our society. And there's a criteria in church teaching for what constitutes legitimate defense by military force, and it's when the damage by the aggressor has to be lasting, grave, and certain. Peaceful means have basically shown that they're not going to work. There has to be a serious prospect of success, and by using arms, we cannot be committing a greater evil than the evil that we're trying to get rid of. And that burden of prudential judgment as to whether the criteria are met, it normally rests with the civil authority, because you will often hear popes speak against a particular war or something. However, our civil authority may have information that the Pope doesn't, so that really becomes a prudential judgment rather than an actual teaching in most cases. But even if it is just for us to take up arms, the moral laws still apply. We can't just loot an area. We can't go and kill non-combatants and people who don't pose a threat. The dropping of the atomic bomb was a definite immoral thing. And, you know, back in the Cold War era, people were definitely concerned about nuclear weapons and the immorality of them. But really, killing a bunch of innocents, it really doesn't matter if you use nuclear weapons or if you use marshmallows to do it. The mass killing of innocents is immoral, gravely immoral. So as Catholics, we are all called to be part of building this culture of life, to oppose the destruction of human life, which is a grave violation of the dignity of the human person and of the love of God, but rather to accept human life as the good that it is, with gratitude towards God for this great gift he's given us. Thank you.